Hi there, it's Marco. Before we get started, I wanted to share some great news. We surpassed the goal for our end-of-year fundraiser. Since the beginning of November, we've been asking you to donate to support the world. From every corner of the globe, people like you answered the call. We raised more than $75,000 to help keep our show going for another year. Your generosity means that our correspondents, editors, and producers can continue to bring you the coverage that you rely on. And it means so much to our entire team to know that you're with us. So thank you once again from all of us here at The World. Now, on with the show.
Protests continue in Kazakhstan. Kazakh troops have fresh orders. Shoot first, ask questions later. Also today, look up. That plane in the sky might be a ghost flight.
Ghost flights are largely empty planes that airlines are flying because they need to keep valuable slots at some of the most crowded airports in the world.
And as children head back to class, what to do about Omicron? In India, children are weighing the trade-offs.
I think online school is very boring. I don't like it very much. You feel very lonely.
But are in-person classes safe? And the Italian city of Padua has a pantheon of statues.
You walk among them, that's a man, that's a man, that's a man. Oh my God, there's only men.
But adding a woman to the mix is making waves. I'm Carol Hills. It's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We begin today in the Central Asian nation of Kazakhstan, where protests, turmoil, and violence continue for a sixth straight day. The president of Kazakhstan, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, addressed the nation earlier today. President Tokayev gave orders to security forces to shoot without warning at people he called terrorists. Tokayev also thanked Russian President Vladimir Putin and other leaders for sending troops to Kazakhstan to help restore order. The protests began after a sharp hike in gas prices. Internet and cell phone connections in Kazakhstan have been spotty the past few days, but we were able to reach former journalist Dulat Yaznazar in Nur-Sultan, the capital of Kazakhstan. I asked him to describe what he's seen in the past couple of days.
It all started with just peaceful protests about the gas prices in the west of Kazakhstan. But then on the third day, I guess, the other cities, especially in Almaty, people started to fight with government forces. At that time, I was in Shymkent, which is like south of Kazakhstan. I was visiting my family over the holidays. My parents live near the city administration, and from the window, for the last 3 days, we've been seeing lots of people going into the city hall and destroying the city hall. There have been clashes between the government forces and the rioters. They burned down police cars. They burned down the buses. In the morning when I went out to the streets, I saw lots of businesses on the first floor. They've been destroyed. There were cars, especially the construction cars, out on the street. Supposedly, these rioters, they took these cars and used these vehicles to attack government forces. And also, we've been, for the last 3 days, we've been hearing stun grenade blasts and tear gas around our house.
Are you seeing many Kazakhstan security forces? Who is responding to the protesters?
Yeah, government Kazakhstan forces, yes.
And are people safe in their homes in places like Shymkent? Are your family and friends safe there?
Yes, I can say that we are safe. I just spoke to my family and they said that the last night it was like a peaceful night. There weren't any clashes. So I hope that starting from today, it's all going to be all right. We hope so. I don't know.
What do you want outsiders to understand about the situation in Kazakhstan? What is important for people who are hearing about this crisis and hearing about this uprising? What do you want them to understand about Kazakhstan?
Right now, I just want it to end. I want everything back in normality. It was stressful, like these couple days. Most people I talked to, they just want everything back, you know. The problem is that the Kazakh economy is digitized and we don't have internet. So you can't do anything without internet here. You can't even pay for your like bus. You can't even pay in the stores. So the biggest problem right now is that we don't have cash and the long queues to get the cash in ATMs. So yeah, that's the problem.
So your country has kind of ground to a halt during these protests and riots. I mean, are people going to work and going to school, or is everything kind of on hold?
Well, we have the winter holiday for school, and it was extended for 10 days. Concerning the work, everything related to internet is on hold right now. So people, I assume they're just staying at home. My work is also related to this, you know. I need internet to do my work, so we've been just staying at home. In Almaty, they don't have internet at all because there are still fights ongoing, and we just talk to them over the phone, and they say that they stay at home. They're afraid to go out because it's pretty dangerous out there.
Dula Yeznazar is a former journalist. We've been speaking to him from the capital of Kazakhstan, Nur-Sultan. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kara.
To add some more context to what's going on right now in Kazakhstan, we turn to Erica Marat. She's an associate professor at the College of International Security Affairs, and she joins us from Washington. Erica, Kazakhstan is this huge country in Central Asia, the ninth largest in the world. It has a long northern border with Russia. Is it fair to say that Kazakhstan's history is intertwined with Russia's?
Yes, absolutely. It is intertwined. Both countries lived through the Soviet regime and came independent together in 1991. And they share a long border between Russia and Kazakhstan.
But in practice, how much has Kazakhstan remained in the political orbit of Russia?
Very much so. The two countries need to have friendly relations because of the large ethnic Russian population in Kazakhstan, especially in northern parts of Kazakhstan, because of economic ties, energy ties, and also cultural ties, thanks to the Soviet regime that spread the importance of Russian language across its territory. Kazakhstan was able to maintain a balance between the influence of Russia, the rising influence of China, and also maintain friendly relations with the European Union and the United States.
It's interesting because I think for some of us looking at the country now, we're sort of understanding it's had the same leader for almost 30 years, Nursultan Nazarbayev, and he's basically handpicked the current president, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev. Give us a sense of the level of freedom in Kazakhstan pre-protests.
Kazakhstan is an authoritarian country where some criticism of the government was tolerated. Various activists and political commentators, they could criticize specific policies adopted by the government and critique the government, but not really the leaders, not Nazarbayev and not Tokayev. So that was the red line for criticism. And at the same time, there are elements of civil society across Kazakhstan. There are activists, there are labor unions, there are movements all across the country that tried to call the government to become more politically open, inclusive, representative, and so on.
Put it in context for us. What's going on now?
The ongoing protests in Kazakhstan have absolutely been creeping up for a while now, especially for the last 2 years since Nazarbayev stepped down. And the uniting feature of all the protests that took place previously and are currently also ongoing is the people are fed up with kleptocracy, corruption of the Kazakh government. Kazakhstan is an oil-rich country. It has seen vast economic growth over the past 30 years, but the economic prosperity has not been equal across Kazakhstan. There are incredibly rich business elites in the country and also at the same time impoverished population, especially in Western Kazakhstan where oil and gas reserves are and feel like their interests are not represented in the government.
Do you feel like there's a way out of this current situation, that there is there's going to eventually be a dialogue and reforms, or do you see this kind of basically going south, that this is not going to end well?
I think for many, it is already not ending well. We hear of dozens of people killed by armed forces in Kazakhstan. And unfortunately, President Tokayev chose this hardline approach to contain protests. The current or future governments will be able to prevent similar levels of mobilization is by actually opening up a dialogue and trying to reform the political system to make it more competitive, more representative, to perhaps conduct new parliamentary elections or introduce constitutional amendments. That's the only way out for this country.
And what are the key business interests that, say, the U.S. has in Kazakhstan?
Kazakhstan is, of course, oil and gas rich country, but there are many other minerals and natural resources in Kazakhstan, including uranium. It's one of the biggest producers in the world when it comes to uranium. United States is also interested in Europe's energy security, and Kazakhstan is part of that by supplying gas and oil through the Caspian Sea going to Europe, bypassing Russia.
Finally, Erica, what would you like Americans to understand about Kazakhstan today?
It is a story of regular people rising up against all odds, against authoritarian and brutal regime, demanding for a more fair distribution of economic opportunities, for political representation, and for democratic development.
Erica Marat is an associate professor at the College of International Security Affairs. She's been following the developing situation in Kazakhstan and spoke with us from Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When it comes to historical monuments, Americans have learned that conversations about their appropriateness can be quite difficult. This week, Italians got a taste of this. Officials in Padua, a small city not far from Venice, proposed a new statue of a woman for its central square. Cue the controversy. John Last reports from Padua.
Prato della Valle is not like other squares in Italy. In any other town, a square might host a prominent statue or two of a saint or a duke. Padua's iconic square, the biggest in Italy, has 78 of them, life-size sculptures of local celebrities from the Roman historian Livy to the astronomer Galileo. Francesca Tomei is an archaeologist and an organizer with Mi Riconosci, a group that studied gender representation in public spaces.
The idea of this statue was to represent a sort of secular pantheon of the city.
Tomei's group says there's one big problem with this pantheon. It's all men.
You walk among them, that's a man, that's a man, that's a man. Oh my God, there's only men.
Esther Lunardin is another organizer with Mi Riconosci.
That's somehow depressing, you know. As a young woman, I felt depressed.
Together with Tomei, she performed a survey of all the monuments in Italy and found just 200 were of women.
But the point is not the number from our point of view, because what we found out is that there is a big problem in how these women are represented.
Half of those female statues were of saints or fictional characters, they found, not exactly role models for modern Italian women. And almost all of the statues, she said, were, shall we say, a little unrealistic.
Very often, these figures are very, very beautiful. Not just common women you see on the street, but very beautiful ones with a perfect body. They're women made to be looked at by men.
This is not news to many in Italy. Last September, officials in the southern town of Sapri landed in hot water when they unveiled a statue of a fictional peasant woman from a famous Italian poem, which depicted her in a form-fitting, transparent dress. But when Mi Riconosci published their survey, it spurred calls for change at Padua's progressive city council.
After a few days, these two councillors in Padua came up with this proposal.
Add a woman to the 78 statues of men.
And all this very huge debate was triggered and exploded.
The counselors thought they had the perfect person in mind, Elena Corona Piscopia, a 17th century graduate of the University of Padua, who became the first woman in history to obtain a PhD. But that wasn't how a lot of townspeople saw it, and soon a debate erupted in the local papers. Opponents argued that adding Piscopia's statue would be meddling with history.
I really don't feel any need to modify such a perfect balance, you know what I mean? Just for an ideological point of view.
This is Carlo Fumian, a professor of modern history at the University of Padua. Fumian says the plan is misguided and points out that the university has a statue of Piscopia already. It's a stop on the guided tour. Better yet, in 2019, it opened a center for gender studies named for her. People on both sides of the debate in Padua have been surprised at how quickly it has escalated, inflamed by the attention of international media, including the New York Times. For Lunardin, the point isn't really about adding one statue to a public square.
I mean, it's still one woman among 78 men. That's not the point. The point is not changing public space, but changing the mind of people in society.
Lunardin counts it as a victory that so many people are now talking about how women are represented in Italy's public spaces. Padua City Council will make its decision on Piscopia's statue later this month. For The World, I'm John Last in Padua, Italy.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Parents have had an anxiety-filled week, checking each day to see if their kids can go back to school or whether they'll be heading back to the screens and more virtual learning. Across the globe, administrators, teachers, and parents are dealing with this as coronavirus cases spike and grappling with the vexing question, what's the best way to keep people safe, kids learning, and parents working? The World's Chavi Sachdev has our story from Mumbai, India.
Attention!
This is the sound of a typical morning assembly at a school in India. The day starts with students and teachers gathering in the schoolyard for announcements and sometimes a prayer. It was a daily routine up until March 2020. That's when school children across the country were introduced to the concept of online classes. This month, parents, teachers, and kids were poised to re-enter the classrooms full-time. But now the Omicron variant has put the skids on that. For parents, it's a nuisance.
It's been so long now that I really can't remember how it was when he went to physical school.
That's Teresa Khanna talking about her son, Shreyas. They live in New Delhi.
So Shreyas is in grade 5 and he went to school for the full long day last in March 2020. He's been to school again in November for a couple of days, like half a day, with fully masked, all COVID protocols in place.
In Mumbai, where I live, only middle schools and high schools reopened last year, but with the option of online school for those who didn't want to risk the classroom. But almost as soon as they restarted, they closed again. 10-year-old Shreyas was to return to school on the 10th of January, but now he's back online.
I think online school is very boring. I don't like it very much. You feel very lonely. It's unlike going to school and chatting with your friends between the 15-minute breaks in each class. The 15-minute breaks here are me just sitting on the bed and doing nothing. So I really don't enjoy what the school has done.
I think I miss real school a bit. Not a lot, because sitting and playing video games the whole day is actually pretty enjoyable. But I think playing on the playground in my school and having funny chats with my friends and eating food and discussing everything with my friends is just a little too good. So I definitely would like to go back to school, if possible.
It's not just the kids who aren't finding it fun. Indian teachers, like those across the world, say the pace is exhausting. Teaching online is much harder, and they can't tell if the kids are actually paying attention. It's even harder for kids in rural India, and 70% of Indians do not live in big cities. That's according to Rushda Mujib. She works with the Bernard Van Leer Foundation, an organization focusing on early childhood development in India.
I think this has put a lot of stress on young children and their caregivers, and it's not always easy, of course, to adapt as quickly.
One problem is the tech. Having someone at home to sort out computer issues is one thing, but for so many lower income families, access itself is a problem.
It's not always affordable. Parents that may not have access nor understanding of the digital technologies that are in use.
Personally, I know, like, my aunt, she has her gardener's son come home every day to use her mobile phone because they don't even have a mobile phone that has good, like, a big screen or Wi-Fi where they are.
So there are several layers to this. There's the internet piece, there's the smartphone piece. I know many young children that we're hearing about that have to borrow smartphones to be then able to borrow internet to be able to access.
The long-term impact on kids remains to be seen. In September, a group of researchers documented a four-year learning deficit among underprivileged kids. What that means is that a child who was in the third grade in 2020 and is heading to fifth grade this year would exhibit the reading skills of a first grader. Here's Rushda Mujib again.
There was a report out by UNICEF last year saying that 42% of children between the ages of 6 to 13 years have not been able to access any form of remote learning in India. I think this has put a lot of stress on young children and their caregivers.
Another area for concern is nutrition for the kids who cannot go to school now. India has a successful long-running school lunch program in government schools. Mujib says that for a lot of children, lunch is the main reason their parents sent them to school.
In many cases, that is perhaps the only meal or a big chunk of the food that the child will have during a day. And that has been severely affected, obviously, with the school closure.
She says malnutrition could become more of a problem, and that impacts kids' ability to learn. Mujib says school closures are also likely to affect the education of girls in India.
For young girls, this is especially an issue where they have dropped out of school, whether they will be allowed by families to actually go back to school again, depending on a range of socioeconomic and societal factors.
It's not all doom and gloom, though. Mujib says schools have adapted to a tech environment at an astonishing pace. Remote learning tools are getting better. And for many parents and children, school from home and work from home have resulted in stronger bonds and a lot of quality time together. Teresa Khanna says her son Shreyas is trying new things this school year.
So he did a lot of coding classes all of last year, and then we signed him out of those. He started with online chess. To balance out everything online, we've also started badminton coaching for him, because it's a low physical contact sport and you don't really need to be face-to-face with anybody. So yes, that's going on too. And that also helps, because a whole day of classes online and then maybe gaming is followed by a couple of hours of physical exercises and going out of the house.
I feel that I don't feel very well, because not going to school doesn't feel right. You know, I used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and dress up. The bus used to come at 6:30. You know, all of that is now gone. I have to wake up at 9, even though it's a little bit more convenient. It's not good for me mentally.
For kids like Shreyas, at least until the next announcement from the government, school life will mostly stay online. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
Coming up, want to know what makes one country more effective than another at battling COVID? Trust. And a new vaccine is shaking up the way vaccines are developed. Plus, we take off for the skies. We're talking ghost planes, parties in the sky, not a good thing. And the future of flights without fossil fuels. How the industry can create a greener future in the clouds.
The most significant thing is the introduction of sustainable aviation fuel and hydrogen.
That's all ahead on The World. Ever wonder what a Christmas tree might taste like?
We always think that they're going to taste like car air freshener, like cleaning products, because that's what we associate pine, fir, and spruce with.
Nope. Stick around and we'll tell you the culinary possibilities. Plus, can eco-conscious air travelers have their cake and eat it too? The promise and reality of green airline travel, coming up on The World.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Have you ever heard of ghost flights? That's when airlines deliberately fly empty planes. It's become a big problem during the pandemic. Here to explain why is Carl Moore, who teaches business strategy at McGill University. He joins us from his office in Montreal. Professor Moore, what exactly are ghost flights?
Ghost flights are largely empty planes, sometimes literally no passengers at all, but otherwise very few passengers, that airlines are flying because they need to keep valuable slots at some of the most crowded airports in the world. Because if they lose them, it's going to cost them a huge amount of revenue in the future.
And by keeping them, it means landing certain numbers of planes there enough to keep them?
Absolutely. It means that if you have a slot going from, let's say, Heathrow to Charles de Gaulle in Paris, you need to have those flights relatively on the schedule that you've told the government you would run them on. But during the pandemic, the need for those flights are down dramatically. So when you look at it, Lufthansa said that they're going to have about 18,000 unnecessary flights for the winter to hold on to the landing slots. These landing slots are extremely valuable to the airlines, and they simply do not want to lose them.
So why is this the system if it's causing so many ghost flights?
Well, this is unusual times. We've never seen this before in aviation history, this cancellation of thousands of flights every week. And the EU, like any government, and the FAA, to a small degree in the US, look to the world in a rearview mirror and they set up regulations based on the normal times. So something like this comes along, it's more problematic.
Is this the practice just in Europe? We're focusing on the EU, or are there slotting rules at all major airports around the globe?
It's only a relatively small number of airports. In the U.S., there's really three of them. That is Ronald Reagan, as well as the two airports, the big airports in New York.
Then if this is the practice in just a handful of places, it sounds like there's models for doing it differently. Why doesn't the EU and these other airports switch?
Well, the U.S. has set a good example by putting it off till March, that they don't have to worry about that. The EU is just a little bit too conservative in this matter. And that's why the airlines are pushing them forward. Environmental activists are pushing the EU to change how their approach is. And I think they will fairly rapidly because of the amount of press coverage that's around the topic. And it's something which is rightly embarrassing to them.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, yesterday, climate activist Greta Thunberg tweeted this to her millions of followers. She wrote, "Brussels Airlines makes 3,000 unnecessary flights to maintain airport slots." That's just one airline. So just remind us how widespread the practice is of flying these empty planes.
Highly unusual in the past, but during the pandemic, it's something that they've done in order to keep the slots. And it's just an unbelievable reduction of number of passengers during the Omicron virus of the last month or so. So these are highly unusual times. Lufthansa is estimating will do 18,000 unnecessary flights in the winter to hold on to the landing slots. And I think they're publicizing that to encourage the EU to calm down about this and to put what the FAA has done in the U.S., put a hold on the necessity of doing this.
What are the business reasons for changing these rules?
Well, they're wasting a lot of money, and it's environmentally a huge impact. But it's also the financial side of airlines are in deep trouble because of the pandemic. Some are going to go bankrupt. Most of them are getting government help. For example, Lufthansa now has members of the government on their board because the German government has given so much money to Lufthansa. So it's something where it's a huge economic problem for these airlines. Most of them without government support would no longer be around. And we need the airline industry for many, many reasons. And so government support makes sense, but the airlines would rather run their businesses as businesses, do things that are sensible, rather than having ghost flights, which costs a huge amount of money, and it's just done for governmental reasons.
Carl Moore is a professor of strategy and organization at McGill University. He was giving us the lowdown on so-called ghost flights. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Carol.
Let's stay in the air a bit longer. Denmark's prime minister set a New Year's resolution for the whole country last week to power domestic flights without using fossil fuels by the end of the decade. The ambitious green aviation goal is just the latest by a Nordic country. The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, reports on where we're at with sustainable flights.
Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen announced the target during her annual New Year's speech.
Lykkes vi med det, så vil det være et grønt gennembrud.
If we succeed, then it will be a green breakthrough, she said. Not just for Denmark, but for the whole world.
Bliver det svært? Ja. Kan det lade sig gøre? Ja, det tror jeg.
Will it be difficult? She said. Yes. Is it possible? Yes, I think so. Aviation is responsible for about 2.5% of global carbon dioxide emissions, and it's going to be one of the hardest industries to decarbonize. That's partly because batteries are too big and heavy to be a practical solution for large, long-haul airplanes anytime soon. So the industry is looking to develop two other technologies to help meet its target of decarbonizing by 2050.
The most significant thing is the introduction of sustainable aviation fuel and hydrogen.
This is Elliot Lees, a VP of Clean Transportation at the consulting firm ICF. We'll get to hydrogen in a minute, but first, a look at that sustainable aviation fuel.
Sustainable aviation fuel goes into existing jet engines and existing aircraft, but comes from an alternative source other than fossil fuel.
An alternative source like used cooking oil, plant oils, wood residue, or even our trash. The idea is that these fuels are made from crops that are then replanted to recapture carbon dioxide, or from waste that would otherwise decompose and emit greenhouse gases naturally. That means lower carbon emissions than traditional jet fuel, up to 80% lower, according to the industry. The alternative fuel is already being blended into regular jet fuel in small amounts, and the first plane fully powered by it flew from Chicago to Washington, D.C. last month. Here's Lees again.
The trajectory is pretty significant that in the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to become a important source, still small, but an important source of how the airlines are going to deal with reducing their emissions.
Right now, well under 1% of all the jet fuel used each year is the sustainable kind. Robert Boyd from the International Air Transport Association says that will have to increase exponentially, up to as much as 80%, to help the industry meet its sustainability goals.
It's feasible. I don't sit here and say it's just a walk in the park. It is incredibly difficult. It will be one of the major, I think, decarbonisation achievements of this century. But it is possible.
Boyd was speaking in a video Q&A posted online. He said there are a lot of challenges to ramping up sustainable fuels, like sourcing enough oil, crops, or wood residue in a sustainable way.
That's key. We're not going to use something that's not sustainable.
Boyd projects up to 5% of the jet fuel used by 2030 could be sustainable, and that could be enough to fuel Denmark's roughly 36,000 annual domestic flights. The decade after that deadline, bigger changes are expected to arrive on the tarmac, planes that run on hydrogen fuel.
That is going to be this revolutionary leap in aviation.
Amanda Simpson is the VP for Research and Technology at Airbus Americas.
One of our mid-range plans is to have a hydrogen-powered aircraft in service with an airline by the mid-30s. Our target date, of course, is 2035.
Eventually, the idea would be to use hydrogen fuel made with renewable energy. At the beginning, though, Simpson says there probably won't be enough of that so-called green hydrogen to fuel hydrogen planes. Even making enough hydrogen from dirtier sources to power Airbus's new aircraft will be a challenge.
Keep in mind, you have to have the ecosystem to support them, right? No one's going to use an aircraft that can't be refueled.
The aviation industry is not advocating for less flying as part of the solution to reducing emissions. That's something left to citizens' initiatives like the flight-shaming movement and the government of France, where some short domestic flights will soon be banned in favor of train trips. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
While we're talking flights, on a recent one from Montreal to Cancun, Mexico, this happened. A party broke out mid-flight. Dancing in the aisles, vodka, vaping, and not a protective face mask in sight. All captured on video and shared on social media. Some Canadian reality stars and influencers chartered the flight. The outrage was swift. Sunwing Airlines canceled the return trip home. Two other carriers also banned them from flying. Even Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau weighed in.
And it's a slap in the face to see people putting themselves, putting their fellow citizens, putting airline workers at risk by being completely irresponsible.
The TikTokers also had a field day. In this video, Montreal comedian Nir Guzinski has a back and forth with himself about the incident.
They filmed themselves.
Uh-huh.
It was stupid. But why are they called influencer? What exactly do they influence? Stupidity?
Yeah.
Another TikTok pretends to show the point of view of trapped Canadians under palm trees.
I want to go home. I want to go home!
If they can't get a flight back to Montreal, they've got a long drive ahead of them, 3,600 miles and some 60 hours behind the wheel, and some hefty fines for violating Canada's transport regulations, close to $4,000 per violation. That's one costly party.
Global leaders have called it the biggest mistake of the pandemic. 2 years in, many parts of the world still lack access to life-saving treatments and vaccines for COVID-19. That's fueled record surges in infections and new variants and has completely overwhelmed hospitals. But as the world's Alana Gordon reports, a new vaccine is shaking up the vaccine development model and raising hopes for the next phase of the pandemic.
Maria Elena Botazzi loves bugs. Ever since she was a kid, she's really wanted to understand them. And I'm not talking about the kinds of bugs that you can see, but the really tiny ones that get in our bodies and can make us sick. Parasites. They surrounded her growing up in Honduras.
The one that, you know, I recall the most is these parasitic intestinal worms. I even remember when I was little, you know, I was privileged that, you know, we could afford getting dewormed every so often, with, you know, medicines that are, of course, safe and available relatively cheaply around the world. But many don't even have that option.
Her family were cattle ranchers. They spent lots of time in rural areas. Botazzi also saw from an early age how these diseases could really debilitate families, how health systems struggled. She went on to study these bugs at the University of Honduras, and then she joined a group at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston to develop vaccines and treatments for neglected diseases.
Now, why we want to do this? Very honestly, because nobody else is, right? If we don't do it, nobody will.
Historically, vaccines haven't been lucrative, unlike drugs, which offer the promise of cures. Before the pandemic, they'd even developed a vaccine for SARS-1, but it didn't go anywhere. When SARS-CoV-2 hit, they were on it. They developed a vaccine using a conventional, accessible approach. That's part of their model. For the COVID vaccine, they partnered with a company in India called Biological E. Last week, the Indian government approved it for emergency use. Botazzi is thrilled.
Even though we may be a little bit late in the game, but this is definitely going to be a game changer. And we hope that this is really what's going to help really break the cycle of this surgence of variants and bridge this gap of inequity around the world.
Botazzi has such high hopes because her group is doing something very different. They're openly and willingly transferring their knowledge and know-how to places that would want to make it. They're not putting a patent on it. There's no profit.
This should have been the model right from get-go.
Dr. Madhu Pai is a professor of global health at McGill University in Canada.
Instead, the richest nations in the world preferred to go through the standard pharma model. And it has taken us well over a year to realize that the model is failing.
He says this vaccine, called Corbevax, represents a powerful shift. He hopes it helps democratize vaccine manufacturing and access around the world. Dr. Naor Berzev is a professor of vaccine sciences and international health at Johns Hopkins University. He's also involved with developers in India on a different COVID vaccine. He cautions against looking to Corbevax alone as some kind of game changer.
You know, we tend to have this attitude that this one new thing is going to be the be-all and end-all. And I think that the very question belies an attitude that is not the right one to hold for this pandemic.
Right now, all the data about the effectiveness of Corbevax itself is unpublished. Biological E is reporting it's at least 80% effective in preventing disease. But Berzev wants to see the data, and he says more studies are needed in the real world, like in an era of Omicron.
We still have to be cautious about how specifically we infer from it. I just think we need to be careful of how much we overinterpret.
In Texas, Maria Elena Botazzi and her colleagues are optimistic. They've been in conversation with other manufacturers around the globe, not just in India, in Asia, Latin America.
And many more are now reaching out.
The question now is how quickly those partnerships can turn into real shots in the arms of people who need it. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
The entertainment world has lost an icon. Sidney Poitier, the first Black man to win the Oscar for Best Actor, died yesterday. He was 94. Poitier is largely credited with paving the way for Black actors in Hollywood. He appeared in films including The Defiant Ones, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and Lilies in the Field. Poitier will also be remembered for much more than just his work in front of the camera. He became an outspoken advocate for racial justice and the civil rights movement. Even as a young actor, he rejected roles that he felt reflected badly on people of African descent. The late actor grew up in the Bahamas. That nation's Prime Minister, Philip Davis, remembered Poitier's legacy this afternoon.
Our country is in mourning. But even as we mourn, we celebrate the life of a great Bahamian, a cultural icon, civil and human rights activist. We admire the man not just because of his colossal achievements, but also because of who he was.
Sidney Poitier died yesterday. He was 94. Why are some countries doing better when it comes to fighting COVID? Turns out how much we trust one another has a lot to do with it. That's what researchers in the UK and the Netherlands found out. A new study was published yesterday in a journal called Scientific Reports. Martin Scheffer is one of the co-authors. He's also professor of complex systems at Wageningen University and joins us from the Netherlands. Martin, tell us what you were setting out to discover when you started this study of 150 countries.
Like many others, we were just curious why the success of countries in fighting back the first COVID waves was so different. We found that some countries were doing that like 40 times faster than other countries. And we were just, like many people, wondering why that was. So we started digging into all kind of potential explanations. And to our surprise, we found that social factors may be the most important one, and especially people trusting each other, surprisingly, seemed to be a decisive factor.
And how did you figure that out?
We looked at the question, would you say that most people can be trusted? And then we looked at the percentage of people that actually agree that most people could be trusted. And that appears surprisingly to be a quite strong predictor of how well countries were able to fight COVID. I'm talking about the pre-vaccination time. So in those days, the most important thing was actually social distancing, complying to the measures. And apparently, this differed a lot between countries.
So give us an example of like a high-trust country and a low-trust country.
Well, a high-trust country could be Sweden, could be Holland, where I'm living. Also, China is a high-trust country. Any country where more than 40% of the people agree that most people can be trusted, they do good.
How does the U.S. measure up on this trust issue?
Oh, the U.S. is not doing very well, and the U.S. is actually losing trust. So less and less people agree that most people can be trusted.
What are the countries that show up the most on the trust scale?
They tend to be countries where people feel there is social justice, so to say. So it's typically the Scandinavian countries score very high on the trust scale. Trust is correlated to having welfare systems in place. Trust is low in countries where there is large inequality, especially when people feel that inequality is unfair.
Why did you decide to measure trust as opposed to something else?
We measured many other things. Because trust is only one thing. There is quite elaborate system of measuring cultural dimensions, like how hierarchic is a culture, how religious. There are many dimensions. We also checked trust specifically in different institutions, in government. We checked all of those. And the thing that just stood out as the most powerful explainer was this generalized trust, people trusting each other, basically.
Why is trust so important?
I think that in situations of disasters where you need to cooperate to do things, trust brings society things that money can't buy. So you need to act in concert. This is, of course, something that's not specific to the COVID case, that it's important. I'm also thinking COVID won't be the last disaster. It won't be the last pandemic. It won't be the last extreme climate event that we need to respond to. So clearly, trust is a kind of insurance that helps you pull through difficult times.
Martin Scheffer is a professor of complex systems at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. Thanks for speaking with us.
Welcome.
For those of you who celebrated Christmas, the living room tree is likely on its way out the door. But before you kick it to the curb, consider this, repurposing it in the kitchen. The World's Bianca Hillier tells us how.
When I first heard about eating a Christmas tree, I had one main question. Does it taste like it smells? I asked Julia Georgialis, a food writer and baker in London.
We always think that they're going to taste like car air freshener, like cleaning products, because that's what we associate pine, fir, and spruce with.
Thankfully, that's not the case. She says each of these trees has a unique taste.
Pine's quite subtle and quite warming in a way. Fir is really grassy, and spruce has a similar flavor profile to vanilla.
Georgialis knows all of this because since 2015, she's been hosting pop-up Christmas tree dinners. As you can imagine, there was a lot of trial and error before any dish made the menu.
Initially, we tried to deep fry fir needles and stuff, and that was awful. And I think there was this really horrible scotch egg that we made, which was really disgusting. So there was like some really bad moments in our testing.
Finally, she cracked the coniferous code and found that treating the needles of the tree like an herb was the way to go.
just like rosemary, right? So you'd use rosemary to cook with, but you wouldn't necessarily eat like a sprig of rosemary.
Georgialis has since whipped up recipes like Christmas tree pickles, white pine sorbet, and a cocktail that requires two large handfuls of spruce, branches included. You can find the recipes in her cookbook, aptly called How to Eat Your Christmas Tree. The concept may seem experimental to some, but Georgialis points out the idea is nothing new.
All this project is really is kind of foraging. You know, you're just kind of eating something that you wouldn't buy in a supermarket. You know, fir and pine and spruce have been cooked with for hundreds and hundreds of years.
In Scandinavia, pine bark is turned into a flour-like substance to add flavor to cookies and breads, while Greek vintners use Aleppo pine sap in their white wine. It's called retsina. And in North America, indigenous cuisine uses evergreen trees in tea, braises, and stews. But before you go running to the kitchen, a warning. Some Christmas trees are poisonous if eaten, including yews and cedars.
You absolutely cannot eat those.
Georgialis also recommends checking to make sure your tree wasn't sprayed with pesticides or other chemicals before you brought it home. If eating your Christmas tree isn't your thing, Georgialis says you can still adopt the sustainable mindset.
It's the idea of just thinking about how you could repurpose things that you wouldn't have otherwise thought about repurposing.
That could mean using parts of the tree for art projects with the kids, wood for your fireplace, or even air fresheners for the car, keeping the holiday spirit around just a little while longer. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Where do you really go from there? That's where we wrap things up this week. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here on Monday.